This is the Roy Downs of Sounds and Colors, and today I have with me one of the great players on the scene, creating lots of beautiful vibrations with the sound, Mr. Rudresh Mahanthappa.
Thanks for having me, Leroy. It's great to be here.
Oh, it's always great to hear you, man, and talk to you and listen to how you express yourself on stage with the music and all of these things and sounds that you're opening up with your contribution to jazz.
Oh, well, thank you so much. It's really it's a real pleasure to put this music out there and for people to enjoy it. I can't ask for anything more.
It'll be good seeing you again. It was great seeing you here in Los Angeles for sure.
Yeah, definitely. I don't know how we're going to get back there again, but hopefully we will.
Oh, man, you definitely will for sure, man. Well, maybe we'll do the Angel City Jazz Festival again.
Yeah, that'd be cool for sure.
Well, listen, you know, I've always been a great admirer of the music, and you're one of the cats that has come on the scene in full force. And with so many elements of different genres in your culture and your music, it's evident that you have a global approach to sound. Is that your gift that you bring to humanity, is the global element in trying to blend the music and the genres together?
Well, I mean, I think I appreciate all the kind words. Thank you. I think, to some degree, I have no choice. I mean, I am Indian American. I inhabit two worlds at once. You know, my parents came here in the 50s, so I was raised with, as a hybrid entity from the very beginning. So I've always had to simultaneously confront and embrace my bicultural existence, and I think by virtue of that, I'm generally open to seeing how things can mix and synthesize and commingle and create something new. Because I've essentially had to do that to define my identity as one of the hyphen Americans that makes up the multicultural landscape of this country.
Well. Being of that mix, I mean, even coming up as a child, did you have to look at the world through both sets of eyes, or is there a certain point in time where you realize that, hey, I have a couple of identities here that I need to address, and you brought those ideas together?
It was definitely more the latter, and it was definitely coming into adulthood, really. I think for children of immigrants, it generally strikes you around that 18, 19, 20 years old, where you kind of, depending on how you grew up. I mean, for me, I grew up in a primarily white community, and then I ended up at University of North Texas for college initially, which had a very significant African-American population, and I think that's where it struck me, where I was like, well, wait a minute, I'm not black, and I'm certainly not white, so what am I? And that's kind of when the confusion, but, fortunately, the journey kind of started of trying to figure out who I am. And, it's not unique to me. And fortunately, there have been some really great Indian American or Indo-Canadian writers that have already kind of tackled this subject through fiction. So I found, reading some of these books and short stories to be, quite therapeutic, to know that there were other Indian Americans kind of going through the same throes of questioning that I was. So how does that play out then? Well, I think embracing Indian classical music and trying to incorporate that into what I was doing goes far beyond the music. Obviously I was interested in the art form, but in a larger sense, it's a way of me expressing that identity and embracing a significant element of my ancestry at a very core level.
As you mentioned, it's not necessarily indicative to you. I think every child comes around that age and tries to identify with themselves. They have things to deal with in terms of how they deal with their parents, how they are dealing with themselves as they're coming into an age and they're finding themselves, how they deal with their community, how they deal with their ethnicity, how they deal with their culture, and who is the person that I'm going to be, and what is going to be my say.
Sure.
Many people try to, at that point, find themselves by identifying themselves through their clothes, through their car, through all of these external things. And luckily for us, you know, you have music with that.
Right.
But at the same time, you know, thinking about that particular age and your parents, you deal with America a different way than maybe your parents deal with America.
Yeah, I'm sure, definitely. But at the same time, yes, there is this process of assimilation. I mean, you know, a very basic expression of that is, you know, what do you do when your five-year-old child comes home from school and says, why don't we have a Christmas tree? So it's like, okay, so, you know, it's a question of choosing your battles, right? It's like, okay, well, we can be adamant about not getting a Christmas tree, or we can get a Christmas tree and put presents under it and do something sort of secular and, you know, and kind of live in both places. So we grew up with a good deal of Hinduism. My parents are still very devout Hindus. You know, there is no language Indian. There are actually, you know, 20, 30 different languages in India, distinct languages. And my parents speak Kannada, which is one of the South Indian languages. They spoke a lot of that with us growing up, but I saw them defer more and more to English as the years passed by. And, you know, I think consequently, my older brother understands a lot more of their native language than I do. You know, I often wonder what language my parents speak when no one is around, now that all the kids have left the house. I would love to actually know. I bet that they don't even know, because it's occurring at such a subconscious level. But so we grew up with a lot of Indian culture, you know, in the home. So for the children, it was a question of, you know, balancing that with everything that we were taking in when we were outside of the home. And, you know, my parents weren't the typical Indian immigrants either. I mean, they were part of the pre-60s waves of immigrants from India were very small, and they were primarily intellectuals that were coming to America for school, for PhDs and such. So I think that, unbeknownst to his parents, when my father came here, he had no intention of going back. I mean, he was very dedicated to the physics the field of physics he was studying and planned on settling here and staying here. So I guess that's all to say that he was a bit of a rebel. I think most people would have done their graduate work and gone back to India, and I think that's what he was expected to do. So it's a little bit of a different immigration story. So I think trying to figure out how to make a life here was definitely a high priority.
Okay. Well, you know, jazz music that is free to express, go beyond space, time, and boundaries, it always allows for all these things to be possible in creativity.
Sure.
And with a world of sound at your fingertips, what is it you aspire to achieve through your approach to music?
Well, I'm just, you know, I'm striving to express myself with as much integrity and honesty as I can, and I think that's a lofty enough goal, and I think if one is able to do that, one is really communicating, and you know, that honesty and integrity always has an ear. You know, there's always an audience for that. So, I mean, what that actually means on any given day can significantly morph from one day to the next, and I don't really have any agendas beyond that necessarily. I mean, I might have strategies as far as the material I'm working with and the concepts I'm working with, but that's a bit of a different story. That's more compositional. I mean, as far as an artistic mission, I'm just trying to be me, and I'm using the music as a way to figure out who I am at the same time.
Well, you know, that right there is one of the most honest answers that you can give, because with music, especially jazz music, we're looking for that openness and that integrity and that soul. We want you to have a signature of voice inside the music. But see, that's just people who love jazz and love the music. Many times I like to think about the audience, and I like to think about where they're coming from, because they're coming from so many different places. There are those who know jazz. There are those who grew up with the music but are so locked into nostalgia. There are those who don't listen with an open ear. There are those who are looking for certain clues in the music and are not freed up to be able to hear new sounds in the music. How is your relationship with the audience And do you think about these things at all, or are you just on stage putting out your art and, you know, hoping that they can receive your vibrations?
Well, I mean, I'm tempted to lean more towards the latter. I mean, but I guess in a little bit of more of a complex way. I mean, I think, you know, the worst audience is the audience that comes with an agenda, right? I mean, the audience member that comes with an expectation of what it is they're going to hear, where they're trying to make what they're hearing fit into some, you know, preconceived or, you know, premeditated mold of sorts. I mean, that's the worst audience member, because they're actually not really, they're not really there to just kind of be open and take something in. So, I mean, I find, especially over the last few years, I have a lot of young people at my shows. I have a very ethnically diverse audience at my shows. And I think they're people of eclectic taste that are not coming there with a particular expectation of hearing jazz as it exists in a museum, or hearing Indian music as it exists in an ancient tradition. You know, they're there for the journey, they're there for the ride. And I think at the very least, you know, there's an energy in the music that I write and the bands that I assemble that I think anybody can gravitate towards. It's the people that overthink it that end up missing out.
Yeah, indeed, indeed. Well, energy is a key part. I mean, attack might be too aggressive of a word, but I like it, because I feel that there's this thing. You may not even know what it is, but you feel its presence and you go after it.
Right.
You're like a scientist with a hypothesis, and you and the band are working on this formula to try to figure it out.
Yeah.
Do you, like, present a skeleton to your band, and then you guys just attack the music from that point of view?
I mean, everything is, you know, all the compositions are written out. I mean, I think, you know, the pieces, I mean, they're compositions. They're set in place, and, you know, there are forms and melodies and harmonies, and then we expand upon those. I mean, I never try to steer the direction in which we're going to take a particular piece, and that's mainly because I've been playing with these guys for so long that, you know, I trust the scenario, and I trust where we'll end up.
Well, even when selecting the right, you know, musicians or scientists, as I said, to work with on your project, I mean, what do you hear from each of your musicians that lets them know that these are the cats that will definitely be able to accomplish your goal, so to speak, in the music?
Well, I mean, I guess it varies from project to project, but I mean, you know, my music is generally perceived as being difficult music. So, I mean, people have to be dealing on a really high level just as far as their musicianship goes. I'm not even talking about art. I'm talking about, you know, their skill set. So that already kind of narrows the field of people that are going to, because I need people who can play my stuff. And relatively quickly, too. I'm not talking about doing one rehearsal and going on tour. But, you know, maybe 5 or 6 rehearsals and some individual time, I'd like to be able to, you know, go play some gigs. So like I said, that kind of narrows the field. And, you know, I've tried to surround myself with like-minded people, people that have been thinking about the same rhythmic and melodic and harmonic concepts, or people that have concentrated on something that I want to incorporate into my music and, you know, kind of explore that direction. And, you know, and it's important to note that every album I've ever recorded was written for the band that's on the album. I mean, I don't write music for guitar. For example, with Gamak, I mean, I didn't write music for guitar, bass, and drums and then go find a band. I mean, I wrote that music for those people to uniquely celebrate their strengths and find some fun and interesting challenges for us as a band. So, I mean, that's not to say that those are not those are the only people that can play this music, but it was written for them, and it uniquely brings out their characteristics individually, and as well as a, you know, a unified and unique band sound, ensemble sound.
You're currently on tour with 2 different collaborations of the band, Gamak being one and Apti being the other, the Indo-Pak Coalition. What are the major differences in sound, approach, and philosophy for both of those different bands, since I'm sure you wrote differently for them?
Well, first of all, I mean, just, you know, one little note. Indo-Pac Coalition really isn't on tour. I mean, we presented that double bill in L.A., but that band is probably going to ramp up again in 2014 with a new body of music. But we actually haven't really done that much touring. But UCLA wanted to do a program where I brought two distinct different groups, so that's what I brought. But as far as the differences, I mean, it's just a different scenario. Indo-Pac Coalition the South Asian focus is very clear and specific. I mean, we're dealing with North Indian and South Indian, both North Indian and South Indian concepts and techniques. But at the same time, we're all jazz musicians, so we can talk about the music in both ways simultaneously, which is very special. You know, and structurally, that music is a bit more authentically, you know, utilizing some of these rhythmic cadences and melodic structures. Whereas, you know, I mean, Gamak, that's not to say that Gamak doesn't utilize some of that same stuff, but at the same time, the music of Gamak, you know, draws on a whole, you know, myriad number of influences that have nothing to do with Indian music, and in some cases, nothing to do with jazz either. So, I think a Gamak is more, almost like an instrumental progressive rock band or something.
Well, I love your use of mantras, very prevalent in many of your compositions. I mean, is that to sync the rhythmic sound waves with people's subconscious to bring them to like this basic platform where you take off from?
I don't think that's my intention, but I think in a way there is this kind of metaphysical resonance that occurs like that. You know, I think the best concerts are when it's not that the band plays great, but it's when there's a sense that the audience and band are one, you know, are this kind of single entity going on this journey together. You know, those sorts of things kind of push that along, you know, facilitate that.
Yeah, well, you know, there's... I mean, you talk about jazz. I mean, there's so many ways that people view it. I love think music. I love music that makes me think, you know, music that lets you wrap your mind and expand around a certain sound without trapping you or knocking you over the head with forced principles or general rules on the lowest common denominator for whatever the formula is. For your version of, you know, quote-unquote think music, I mean, what are some ingredients that you use to free up the space for yourself and for the other musicians to express themselves?
Well, I mean, you know, riffing on what you're saying, you know, the music that's always inspired me as a listener has always been 50% intellectual and 50% instinct, 50% gut, you know, all at the same time. You know, I think Train was like that. I think Bird was like that. I think Prince is like that. I think Johnny Cash is like that. I think Bach was like that. I mean, they're artists. Like, I think a lot of the great music through history has always been, you know, has inhabited kind of the old school way of thinking of right brain and left brain, you know, at the same time. And that's what I've always strived to do as well. You know, I think smart music that's moving is what really communicates. So how have I gone about that? I mean, in lots of different ways. I mean, I've worked with mathematical principles, transcribing beat samples and working on, you know, the melody and rhythm of speech. I've, you know, and then in dealing with Indian music, I mean, Indian music has a very science kind of orientation. I mean, all the percussionists are actually great mathematicians, you know, because they're constantly doing these calculations on the fly to be able to play these very complex and beautiful rhythmic cadences. So, you know, that was one of the things that really kind of blew my mind when I first started looking at, especially South Indian classical music, was how heavily math-oriented it was. And, you know, I think numbers are very beautiful, and I think, you know, I think numbers kind of make the world go round, and they inhabit art in some really interesting and fascinating ways, you know, that are definitely worth, you know, engaging on multiple levels. So, and again, you know, my band, most of the people I play with, you know, whether it was known to me before I started playing with them, or it certainly was known to me after, you know, have thought about a lot of these things as well. I have to say that everybody I play with is, I feel like not only are they really great musicians, but they're really, really smart and very thoughtful, and that comes through in what they do.
I certainly agree with you, you know, and I noticed that a lot amongst many of these musicians, you know, the humility, and they're searching to find different things. When they're being honest, you can hear it come through in their presentation on stage.
Right.
This doesn't necessarily have to do with your current band, but I always would like to know how you hooked up with Vijay and Rez, and when you guys get together and perform, you know, I think about not necessarily what it represents to the jazz community or here in America, but I think about those people that, you know, haven't made it to America yet that are of Indian descent, and how that sound or how that particular thing ties them over to America through the music.
Oh, that's interesting. I guess I hadn't really thought about that. Just because I see it as being more of a new generation of Americans than being immigrants. But I guess we kind of straddle that line. You know, I met Vijay. Vijay and I meeting was an amazing experience for both of us, because neither of us at the time even knew that there was another Indian American trying to play jazz. And beyond that, we were on kind of similar tracks as far as what we were thinking about conceptually. I mean, Steve Coleman actually introduced us.
the music is just an expression of who we are. You think certain things, and then you use music as a language to express all that.
Yeah, because Vijay was doing some playing with Steve, and I was attending a workshop at Stanford where Steve was teaching, and he'd been talking about this pianist. He kept saying Vijay. And I, you know, when I hear VJ, I think of those as being initials of V and J. And I was like, huh. And then finally I just said, is this guy Indian? He said, yeah. I said, oh, is his name Vijay? He said, yeah. I was like, so you're playing with an Indian guy? He's like, yeah, I'll introduce you. And he was very flattering, you know, when he introduced us. He said, hey, Vijay, you know, if I can't, he played a few tracks on Vijay's first album. He said, you know, if I can't make your gigs, you need to call this guy. So we kept in touch over the course of the next year, and then Vijay actually found us a gig up in Toronto, and we got there a few days early, and, you know, we'd never really played together, so we got there early and rehearsed, and we learned some of each other's tunes, and we worked on some standards that we both liked, and that's how we started. We started as a duo, and I think that's ultimately been our strongest work together, and our most interesting and introspective work together. So, and then Rez, how did I meet Rez? I think, you know, when I was moving to New York, somebody told me, oh, when I was in Chicago, someone said, oh man, you got to call my friend Rez, you know, he knows everybody. I was like, oh, okay, he knows everybody, that sounds good. And I called him, and we played together. We played a session at someone's house together, and it was fine. It wasn't particularly mind-blowing or anything. But then a few years later, and I think at that time, Rez actually hadn't really delved into much Indian music. And I always got the sense that when he met his wife is a great ghazal singer, a great North Indian vocalist.
Oh, she sounds fantastic.
Yeah, so he kind of jumped deep in then, and then Rez's next record was just like a whole other thing, and that's when I had a version of the Indo-Pak Coalition when I lived in Chicago that wasn't very successful, and it had always been in the back of my mind to start it up again. And so when I heard Rez's new album, and then I heard what Dan was doing on tabla and in some other situations, I was like, all right, these are the guys, let's get this going again. And so it's going to be exciting for us to make another album, I think. The band has grown so much, and it just has a life of its own that's very special. So it's time for us to start playing some new music.
Oh, beautiful, man. Cool, man. Well, it's always great talking with you, Rudresh.
Sure. Yeah, thank you for the opportunity.
All right, brother. Great talking to you, man.
Cool, man. All right. Take care. Thank you.
Right,
okay. Peace. Bye.